Bibles and turn to Amos chapter 2 tonight. Amos chapter 2. Last week we walked through the first of these nations. We looked at Damascus, which was a reference to Syria. We looked at Philistia, Tyre, Edom, Ammon, Moab, and Judah. And then we put in tonight at verse 6. We left this off because Israel is the prime focus of the prophecy of Amos. All of these are involved, but Israel is the prime focus of Amos's prophecy. And so he's really going to go through and delineate what they were doing, what's happening. And so we want to look at this in a little bit more detail because it's going to be the background for the remainder of this letter. Or this prophecy, excuse me. This isn't a New Testament letter. And so if you look in verse 6, we'll read through this and then kind of walk back through it. It says, "For thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel and for four, I will revoke then, or I will not revoke its punishment or not relent on its punishment, because they sell the righteous for money and the needy for a pair of sandals. These who pant after the very dust of the earth on the head of the helpless. Also turn aside the way of the humble, and a man and his father resort to the same girl, in order to profane my holy name. And on garments taken as pledges they stretch out beside every altar, and in the house of their God they drink the wine of those who have been fined." And so he really does go through and enumerate specifically the charges that he was bringing against the nation of Israel in here. And all of these are charges against them beside the very fact that they had resorted to these other nations that they had or were relying on them, that they were going after Baals, which also is happening. I'm working in Hosea for when we're done with Amos. In Hosea, that's one of the charges against them, was that they were going after these Baals. We often refer to it as Baal, but it's plural, Baalim in the Hebrew, again and again. They were pursuing these, and that's not even something that's enumerated here. Now, if you remember what we talked about when we introduced Amos, all of these nations were experiencing at this moment in time, in their history, in their interaction with one another, in that small region, they were experiencing a time that was sort of unprecedented at that time of prosperity. And usually prosperity comes in the midst of a time of peace, or at least relative peace. Usually when there's war, there are some people that prosper, but there are others who don't prosper. I was just listening the other day, and they were talking about the fact that when World War II was over, they watched the weight of the average American jump 20% after the war was over. Well, they'd had two things that had gone on. They'd had the Depression, so there were a lot of people that didn't eat a whole lot. And then during the war, everything was rationed. And so you still, even if you had money to eat stuff, you still just didn't have as much. But as soon as the war was over, there was this prosperity boom that had taken off. The war building, the war manufacturing supplied that, and it just kind of took off. And there was an unprecedented prosperity across America, and the weight of the average American jumped about 20% in the 10 years following the war. Prosperity brings, or peace, excuse me, brings a certain type of a prosperity with it.
Poor domination.
What?
Poor domination in America since after World War II. All the world's factories were pretty much bombed, and it's just America supplying the whole world.
I see what you're getting. But we're talking about what was happening for these people here in this part of this land here at this time. And so when you have this degree of prosperity, there are certain things that happen. And we, personally here, are all witness to this in America. We see what happens when people have life easy and prosperous, that people tend to take it for granted and things go downhill. And I don't think that there's one of us in here that wouldn't look that over the last 40 years in our country or more, we've seen just a steady decline of just what we would even call general righteousness out among the world. We're not talking about righteousness before God. We're just talking about general human righteousness really gone downhill, okay? And the things that people do. Now, I'm not saying that people didn't do these things at other times or before, but it just becomes more pronounced. Now, we say that because look at the things that he says when he tells, when he goes through and enumerates these. In verse 6, in the middle of the verse, he begins to enumerate in Amos 2:6. In the middle of the verse, he begins to enumerate that because they sell the righteous for money and the needy for a pair of sandals. One of the things that happens, and we have really witnessed this, and the last, in fact, I don't know if any of you read the papers or listen to the news much or all, but one of the things, one of the things here right now that they're worried about is that our country is going to lose its middle class. And the reason they're worried that it's going to lose its middle class is because it is taking more and more to live, because the way things are. Power is becoming more and more centralized. Wealth is becoming more and more centralized for a number of different reasons. But that's the situation that had happened in Israel, was that this prosperity had led to a point in which power had become centralized among the rich, and there wasn't really a middle class. There were the people who had, and there were the have-nots in Israel, and it had created a real disparity. And as a result, the people that had were taking advantage of the people that had not. Now, when he talks about this first one, that they sell the poor, they sell the righteous, actually, is what he is saying here. They sell the righteous for money, and the needy then, the poor, for a pair of sandals. I want to go back and I want to look at a passage in the book of Leviticus, if you would. I want to try to compare these. Not all of these are dealt with specifically in the law, but most of these, there is some reference in the law that will help us understand this. Leviticus chapter 25. Now, in most of your Bibles, your Bibles are all have the same chapter divisions. Chapter 25 goes back where it begins to talk about the laws of restoration. Laws of restoration revolved around the year of Jubilee. Year of Jubilee meaning that when Israel entered the land was all divided among families. It was divided among tribes and then among families. And when a family had land was there, that family's, perpetually. But it was not, see, and I can never remember the difference between continuous is intermittent, continually is constant. So it wasn't continually their land, but it was continuously their land. Now the distinction, see if you remember your English, continuous is intermittent, now and then, but continues. Continually means without a break. Okay. Significance of that is under the way the law was set up, people could sell portions of their land or let portions of their land go to cover debts. But it never permanently became somebody else's land. It reverted back to the family after that generation, essentially after that generation was over, because a generation is roughly 30 years, and so every 50 years, then that land reverts back. And that was God's way of, in the law, keeping power from being centralized. Because, well, I remember people talking that about here where we live. This originally was set up to be small family farms. Now we have farms where we have people that are farming thousands of acres, not families farming 250 to 500 acres. And everybody says, well, you can't make a living on that anymore. Well, that's because of other things that they have done.
Well, I thought the reason that God did that is because the land was their inheritance.
And it was their inheritance.
And they were a people to have, that was their inheritance.
It was their inheritance. But see what happens then, under the law, when God gave that to them, what would happen is if you sold your land because you couldn't afford it, eventually it'd be like where we are today. You'd have a few people that would end up owning most of the land. And all of a sudden, everybody else doesn't have it, and what happens? They don't have their inheritance anymore. It's all gone. So God, by this, was doing two things. He was preventing the rise of one powerful class and maintaining the law of the inheritance for the people of Israel in their land. So that's the background for this. And he talks about the rules. If you ever read the book of Ruth, the whole book of Ruth is based on this. The key to the book of Ruth is the end of Judges, in which it said there was no king in the land, every man was doing this right in his own eyes. And Ruth, as much as we make it a story about Ruth, it's really a story. Well, I shouldn't say it really is, but it's also a story about Boaz, who was a man who didn't do what was right in his own eyes. He did what was right according to the law. He followed the law to the letter. Okay? So Ruth is important because it shows you, here's an exception in the middle of a time. When everybody else is doing what's right in their own eyes, there were some, at least Boaz. Maybe he was the only one, but we assume maybe there was another handful somewhere else that were doing this. And it's always kind of the way it is in every dispensation. Most of the people in dispensation go off and they do not operate according to the principle in the dispensation, but there's usually a handful that do. Okay. Now, in Leviticus 25, having said this about this, we also have a situation about individuals themselves, because what do you do if because of debts, you can't deal with you don't have land to handle. So we have in verse 35, now in the case then of a countryman, that is of a fellow Israeli of yours becomes poor, and his means with regard to you falter, then you are to sustain him like a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. So this is the response. And do not take usurious interest from him. So you weren't supposed to be in a playa in interest, obviously, charge him interest. But revere your God that your countrymen may live with you. You shall not give him your silver at interest, nor your food for gain. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan to be your God. So God was setting up a principle that you didn't have to give these people charity, but at the same time, you weren't supposed to take advantage of them and make a profit. A lot of times what happens is you have, and we see...
Well, yeah, they did have to give into charity because there was a law in regard to gleaning.
Right.
You're not to glean your whole field.
Right, but that's not what he's talking about right here. See, I'm just trying to stick just to this statement, this passage right here, what he's getting at. There were all kinds of things. They even had a tithe every third year that they brought in, and that tithe covered the poor and it covered the widows and such. So they did have... They did have things like this, but what I'm talking about right here is he's not saying you just give them pure charity in this case. You could sell to them, but you didn't sell to them to make a profit. In other words, you don't have to go into the hole for them, but at the same time, the law of supply and demand, God was basically saying we're not going to make it apply here to the poor. In other words, we're not going to say, well, there's a demand, so, you know, jack up the price. Get whatever you can for it. That's the kind of thing that generally people take advantage of in this situation. Or the thing of interest, take advantage of people and provide help for them. So then he says in verse 39, and if a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you, you shall not subject him to a slave service. In other words, even if he sells himself to you, so that he would, from a practical point of view, look as though he's a slave, he's in the position of a slave, you don't treat him like a slave. He shall be with you like a hired man. He's not a hired man. He sold himself to you to cover debt. As if he were a sojourner, he shall serve with you until the year of Jubilee. So again, he does potentially get to go free. He then shall go out from you, he and his sons with you, and shall go back to his family, and he may return to the property of his forefathers. For they are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They are not to be sold. In the New American Standard, it says literally in a slave sale. Literally, the Hebrew does not say that. The Hebrew just, he shall not be sold a slave. It's not that you're putting him on a slave. It's just you don't sell him as a slave. That is not what you do. You shall not rule over him with severity, but you're to revere your God. And that's important because God gave rules. Jews could own slaves. And Jews could even treat their slaves with severity. But they couldn't do it to a countryman that had been that sold himself to them. They were forbidden. And as for your male and female, that's all the further we're going to go there. I could keep going because there's other things that are going on here. And then up in verse 47, there's an implication up here. It says, now if the means of a stranger or a sojourner with you becomes sufficient and a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to him as to sell himself to a stranger who is a sojourner with you. I think you all understand when we say stranger or sojourner, we're talking about a non-Israeli, okay, who is a sojourner with you or to the descendants of a stranger's family, then you shall have redemption right after he has been sold. One of his brothers may redeem him. Doesn't actually tell him that he has to redeem him, but it does say that he can. I think maybe the implication is that, you know, this is the way you should handle it, but God's not requiring it of them. And then it goes through and delineates how they could figure out what the price of the man was going to be based on the time and based on the year of Jubilee and things such as that in the context. But here's the point. God delineated in the law how these people were to be handled. We obviously did have this. In fact, we have Elijah over in the book of 2 Kings, if you remember, that is with the widow of Zarephath, who has children. And he shows up and he says, or she says to him, my creditors have come. And they're coming to take my son and my daughter away as slaves. How would you like that, to be in a situation where your creditors could come and you don't have anything else? So say, you know, they don't want her. And granted, I don't know why we always think this, but when we think of a widowed woman, usually we think of somebody that's elderly. We think of somebody that's old and like this. But this is probably a woman that's in her 20s, maybe in her early 30s. We're talking about a younger woman, but they don't want her particularly. They want the kids because they're strong, they're able-bodied, they can put them to work. That's what they want. And that was the situation. And those creditors had come, and Elijah was then the one that, you know, says, well, what we're going to do, what you're going to do is you're going to sell what you have. She goes, well, I've got a little flour here in this oil. Well, just keep making and keep making. And she just keeps pouring and filling things, everything she has with the oil. And God provides for her so that she can pay off her creditors and not have to sell her kids. Because we had a situation that was going, and remember, when you're in the time of Elisha, you're in a time just prior to this, but you're in this time where this prosperity has gone on among these people. And the result is that, again, the wealthy were taking advantage of the poor, and the poor sometimes were having to sell themselves. And sometimes, even in the case of this widow, her children. And God had given rules under the law about what they were to do. And when they sold them, they weren't really to be sold like slaves. You weren't to deal with them that way. Now, the significance of that is in Amos, if you go back to Amos chapter 2 now, and we could look at others that are going to really reiterate pretty much what we've already looked at. What we looked at is probably some of the clearest, but there are other statements pretty much to the effect of what we saw that delineated the fact that Israel wasn't to do this. And so we're in a scenario here where they are doing what? They're selling the righteous for money. Obviously, now when he says selling the righteous for money, that must indicate that they're selling those who lack means, but they are still righteous individuals, which again is a reminder that simply because a person was righteous didn't guarantee prosperity in it or all situations. Why wouldn't have righteousness guaranteed prosperity for these people? Because if you went back to Deuteronomy 28, it seems like if you obeyed the law of God, you were going to get all the, you get the blessings. And if you disobeyed the law of God, you wouldn't have blessings.
Well, it was based on a national obedience,
yeah,
not necessarily an individual obedience.
And so what's the situation here then?
They're not obeying. Yes.
They're not obeying. So you're in a situation where you have individuals that are keeping law, individuals that are being righteous, but you have other people, unrighteous people, that are taking advantage of them. Okay? You and I don't have to look that far. And maybe the, maybe people that got caught in this, some of them, I personally, and I don't know all the situations, obviously, but I personally would generally say a lot of them probably were talking about the people that took out loans, shouldn't have taken loans out for amounts of money that they shouldn't have taken out, and all the bad debt and everything, and people that took advantage of that. And then you hear about these financial institutions that got in trouble, and the government bailed them out, and they still had people in those institutions that got unbelievably, we would almost call them sinful, although that's a unrighteous, maybe that's a better way to term it. Unrighteous kinds of bonuses and things like in those situations. We look at that and go, why? Because you did business and basically cheated people into taking out stuff that they shouldn't have, talking people into whatever the case may be. And you had that. So you and I, even we can see how that kind of happened. But I would generally say a lot of those people that got those loans weren't particularly innocent in that. Some of them, I mean, you had people that had big eyes and big appetites that couldn't afford those. But there probably were some people that maybe somewhat were innocently taken advantage of too. I mean, you get a little bit of both in situations like this. And so that's the background of this. And the needy for a pair of sandals, which that even then goes so far as to show the first one, they sell the righteous for money, but the second one, the needy for a pair of sandals, shows when you think of the things that you spend money on, a pair of shoes or a pair of sandals, and I have to be honest, I didn't do any kind of research to see, you know, were sandals something that they paid high price and money for in their land. But I don't know that they did. They'd probably be somewhat comparable that if you want to buy a good pair of shoes today, you're going to pay $100 for a good pair of shoes today.
Wasn't that part of like when Ruth, she put her shoes and that was part of the thing of selling yourself? I mean, you know, she put her shoes by Boaz and he knew that that meant she wanted him to redeem her.
It's interesting that you bring that up because that was a single sandal and this is, and that was the thing that happened. And this is a pair. Every commentary I went at talked about Ruth and said this is not the same situation because this is a pair versus a single sandal. And what she did was a token of how they went about showing that you're superior to me. I'm recognizing that you have authority to handle my situation however you choose. And they did that as a token in there where this, the significance of this, the needy for a pair of sandals is saying, what's $100 to you? I mean, none of us are going to blink at $100, but $100 is not the biggest expense you have in life. It's not even one of the bigger expenses you have in life. And yet for these people, they treated the needy as so insignificant. Get that? That's the point. They looked at the needy. Those were so insignificant in their eyes that, yeah, they're worth a pair of shoes. That's the price you put on a human being? A pair of shoes? Pair of sandals? That's the significance of the statement that's being made here. Then it goes on to the next statement. Verse 7. And those then, in verse 7 there, those literally, the ones that are panting for the dust of the earth that is on the head of the poor. Or again, of the helpless. And again, we're in a situation where he is describing how horrible these people were to the poor in the land, that they wanted everything the poor had. Remember, Jesus is going to talk. He's going to deal with the same situation because this situation doesn't go away. this situation goes on so that when Jesus comes on, this kind of problem. And what did Jesus say? You eat the houses of widows. You did everything in their power to manipulate the law, to take advantage of them. This verse 7, and I think all of you can see this, they wanted everything that the poor had. They weren't content to leave the poor living in a shack. They weren't content to leave the poor with anything. In fact, it went so far, they even wanted the dirt that was on top of their head. Doesn't that sound gross? I mean, obviously they don't literally want the dirt, but it's a hyperbole to make a point. They were going to take advantage and get everything from them they could. And so they're craving for, think about this, they're craving for the dirt that's on their head was like somebody panting after water. Nobody pants after dirt. Pant after water. But these people so craved everything that the poor had that he pictures it as even craving to get the dust, the dirt that's on their head. That's how severe this was. They looked at all of these poor in the land, and they looked at all of them as somebody to be taken advantage of. And then also he goes on and he says, and also they turn aside the way of the humble. They turn aside the way of the humble. And see if I can find my note here. I'm not seeing it. I tried to enumerate all these so that I could find them easily, but I don't see it right here. I'm just gonna have to fill you in. I'm sorry I don't have it here. This actually comes up several times in the law that God made it very clear that there were two things that they were not to do with regard to the poor. They were never to accept a bribe against them. In fact, they weren't supposed to accept a bribe, period. But the significance of taking a bribe is who's got the money to bribe? The rich, not the poor. So he says you're not supposed to take bribes. Because normally what the bribes did was it distorted justice against the poor. And God delineates specifically bribes and how it affected the poor. Why would bribes? Well, because as we just said, who's got the money to bribe? You know, it'd be like me coming up and saying, no, I'll bribe you. I got 10 bucks here. God, I'm sorry. You know, maybe 10,000, but not 10. You know, so that was the situation here. And the other issue that comes out was that they perverted justice again and again. They actually showed a prejudice against the poor. God warned them against showing prejudice for the poor or against. They weren't supposed to show prejudice one way or another. They were supposed to keep the law by what the law said. I mean, if a poor person violated the law, they violated the law and there was a penalty. But if they didn't violate the law, And the rich were the ones that violated the law. The rich were to pay the penalty. That's the way it was. That was the law. That was the situation. That's the scenario. And so when he's talking about this here, about turning aside the way of the humble, he's using a statement that is referred to several times in the law about perverting or turning away the poor. They came to you for help, and you turn away and ignore them. Why? Why would you waste your time helping poor people? Help the people that can help you, right? Help the people that you want to be your buddies.
Mine has a cross-reference to Amos 12 where it talks about turning aside the poor in the gate. So wouldn't that be in regard to justice? Because isn't the gate where they
oftentimes
determined what was, that would be like going to court.
Right. Because if you remember, there were different... Where did Lot sit? Lot sat in the gate of his city. Oftentimes, that's where Absalom went to foment rebellion against his father, was in the gate, because that's where people would come, and that's where they conducted business. That's where you went and talked over your problems. And, you know, it's kind of like their public square. So, yeah, exactly. That's the situation. So, again, what we're talking about here is not doing justice. Justice for money. Rather than justice according to the law. Then we come to this next scenario. It says a man and his father then resort to the same girl, which, again, if you turn back to Exodus 21, I've got this one marked plainly. Exodus chapter 21. It says in verse 7, it says, and if a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. If she is displeasing in the eyes of her master, who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. And if he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. In other words, not to be treated then as a slave in that regard. And if he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food or clothing or her conjugal rights. And if he will not do these three things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. So there were, granted, you women may not like that, but the fact is the women didn't have the same rights that men had. And so when men went out and they went out with something to cover their lost time or their situation under these, that did not happen with the women in Israel. But one of the things God is doing here, in contrast to some of the other nations around them, is he is laying down rules that the women were to be treated better than the other nations were treating. And you don't sell them to these foreign people. It's not what they were supposed to do. So they could, there were situations in which people could, because of a debt, could sell a daughter. Okay, just like the widow of Zarephath, that her creditors were going to come and take a son and a daughter both. This is the way that people covered their debts. Okay, I know that sounds very repugnant to us. We're reading something 3,500 years after it was written, but this was actually the way it was. Why did people? What was one of the reasons that you had big families?
It's still that way.
In a lot of parts of the world, mm-hmm. Yeah, that your family is a means of you getting wealth.
China, India.
Yeah, they're your workforce, and they're your means of trading up. I mean, anyway, so it was just it's very different, and lest we condemn them because we're being anachronistic and trying to apply our time and the way things are. But God, if you really understand the other people around them, God is elevating the status of women even in Israel above what it had been. Turn to the book of Leviticus, chapter 18. Leviticus chapter 18, and now that what the situation we have here, when we have this girl that a father and his son going, we went over to Exodus chapter 21 because there was a possibility that a person could buy then a girl, and he could designate her for himself. If you understand what it means to designate for himself, it's as though you're taking her on as a secondary wife. He even indicated that. You could have her, and you maybe could get another wife, but you couldn't change what she had as a one in place. So she's sort of like a secondary wife, which is what a concubine was. Okay, concubine was a secondary wife. They weren't primary wives, but they were wives. I used to think concubine meant something dirty, but it didn't. It just meant a wife of secondary degree. But it was a type of a wife, okay, in their world. Granted, God warned them against multiplying wives and kings multiplying wives, but they seem to have gone down that path anyway. Nobody seems to listen to God because God, what does he know? You know. And so then he says, verse 8, in this context then, it says, and you shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife. It is your father's nakedness. I think you all understand that is a metaphor for a physical relationship. It's not talking about being exposed. It's talking about a physical relationship. That was their metaphor. They've got a couple of metaphors that they use. One of them is knowing, things like that. And so we know what these metaphors are. Then you keep going down there. So he says, not your father's wife. Well, the scenario in Amos is it's father and a son, both, which was in violation of this. If it's a wife, you go on down in the context here, and it's actually switched around in verse 15, and you shall not uncover the nakedness of your daughter-in-law. She is your son's wife. You shall not uncover her nakedness. So God, for both ways, God's covering the background that it was wrong for a father and son then to share somebody. And when they're sharing a girl in this instance, he just laid the background here in the preceding verses with what? The righteous are being sold, the poor for a pair of sandals. They're turning away their justice. So what happens? As a result, you get these people that end up with a girl that they bought and sold, and the father and son both share, which was against the law. They were violating the law. Even though she wasn't a wife in the strictest sense, she would have been, because of what he was doing, would have been taken on it in the very least as a secondary wife. Everybody get the picture? So again, they're violating the law. And this isn't happening with just anybody. The implication is what's the girl? She's one of the poor of the land. Or her father was one of the poor of the land.
Where is it that he warns him not to take the secondary wife?
I'd have to go up and I'd have to look it. I'll try to look that up. But he not a secondary wife. He warns them about multiplying wives is what he warns them about, which would involve secondary wives, but yeah. Because remember, David had wives and concubines both. So he had primary wives and then secondary wives. Same thing with Solomon. Okay. So he had primary wives and secondary wives. Okay. It's just really a situation, again, so very different from the way we're used to operate. Now we go back to Amos. We're flipping back and forth. If you haven't done so already, I'd make sure you have something stuck in Amos because we're going to be going back another one here. Then we come... And by the way, remember at the end of verse 7, it says, in order to profane, they're doing this in order to profane my holy name. Profane, remember, means, their word meant to make common or to literally, that word profane meant to step on it. It was the Hebrew word talked about something like a threshold of a door. What does everybody do at the threshold of a door? It's probably the one space in your house everybody walks on. Because I'm going in and out of it every day. May not stand over in that corner or that corner, but everybody goes in and out of that threshold every day. And so that was the idea of that idea of profane in the Hebrew was, is everybody walked through there. It was so common. Everybody walked on it. And this was one of the reasons. If you remember under the law, God gave them the law for a couple of reasons. One of them was, is that if Israel kept the law, it would be their righteousness in the sight of the people. And one of the things that the people would say that watched them is, what kind of people are these that have such a great God that is right there in their midst? And they will see your righteousness. What are these people doing? They're doing something that defames or treats God's name, his character, as being so common. It's like a threshold. Everybody walk on it. Our God's no different than yours. We do the same kind of stuff that you other nations out there do. So. Goes on here. Next one then, in verse 8. And it says, and on the garments taken as pledges, they stretch out beside every altar. Now there's two possibilities for the word stretch out here, and we'll deal with both of those before we talk about the garments as pledges. That concept of stretching out, there were two ways that a person stretched out. A person stretched out to sleep. What was the other way that a person stretched out? What was the other thing you stretched out for, other than sleeping? To eat. You'd stretch out and you'd lean on your arm. You'd lay down. You'd recline and you'd lean on your arm and lay down there. So one of the possibilities, and the reason we say that is because the next charge against them is that in the house of their God, they drink wine of those who have been fined. So it appears, because of the way this is tied, these are kind of couplets in here, the way this and this, and this and this, and this and this. And in this case, the couplet that is tied together here in verse 8, when he's looking at this, is that while they're drinking the wine of God in these places, before these altars, because they're at altars, notice, by the way, that altar, beside every altar implies a plurality of altars, and yet how many altars were there to go before?
Supposed to have one.
And yet there were three in Israel. There were two that were set up by Jeroboam, and there was another one that was set up across the river, or on the other side of the river later on in their history. Not to mention then all the altars of Baals, but this is the altar of their God. New American Standard at least puts a capital G, although I would question whether or not that should be a capital G, because it's more likely that they were worshiping Israel at this time, obviously was worshiping false gods. But the issue is they're probably eating. So could be sleeping. could be stretching out on these to sleep, but it seems probably more likely in the context that they're stretching out to eat, okay? And in doing so, and this stretching out to eat, this is another thing about it. What time of day did you stretch out to eat? So you would, you know, I don't understand this. This was their, this is what we call supper, okay? Okay. This isn't lunch. This is breakfast. They're doing this in the evening. Okay. That, isn't that when you eat supper? You don't eat supper at noon. You don't eat supper at four. Well, unless you're in Florida and you're in the 60 plus crowd, then maybe you eat supper at four. But other than that, most people don't eat supper at four. Say, yeah, that was a joke. It's supposed to be a stupid joke. Anyway, now let's take a look at this issue of the garment. If you look in Exodus 22.
Now, one thing about the phrases, those of and fine, can you explain that again? I think last week you mentioned that. I can't remember. What does that mean, fine?
Well, there's two issues. And the one thing is there's no fine of wine. There's no, this word that's used here is, and I have to look up my verse here and take a look at the word here. This is verse 8. And it's the word fine there. It's a participle, actually. So it's things that are being fined or things that are being charged as a debt to these people. Apparently charged as a debt because of a violation of the law. So this, again, is showing you what's happening at the time of Christ, happening even here in the Old Testament, that what these people are doing is going around and they're finding all these poor people. And they're going, oh, you did this, and you broke this law, and you broke this law. They were finding things that they could charge people for and fine them for. So those people had to pay fines. Now, that, so then the next question is did they pay a fine of money, and then these people bought wine, or was wine itself the fine? We don't know. Scriptures don't tell us. All we know is that there was a wine associated with some sort of a charge that was against these people. And the charge apparently is for a violation of the law. Whether these people legitimately violated the law or violated the law by the traditions that were being developed.
So from the poor people, they took their clothes because that's the only thing you have value?
Well, that's the next thing we're going to go back up and deal with. But they took charges and had wine of these things and then went into the house of their God and drank. Okay. And the play on, that's interesting here, when you come into verse 8 and it talks about the house of their God. In this case, it's Beth Elohim, but frequently, as we're going to go through here, we're going to have Beth El, house of God. House of God being Bethel, which is where one of the altars was at. So there's almost like a play on words here, a play off this, that they're not coming to the house of God. They're coming to the house of their gods. Now, let's go back then. Did that answer your question well enough, probably? Okay, now we go back to Exodus 22. Exodus 22. It says in Exodus 22 and verse 25, it says, if you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you are to return it to him before the sun sets. That is, they would have it returned before they reclined to eat the supper. Okay? For that is his only covering. Now, well, you and I don't wear cloaks. We wear coats. But they lived in a part of the world where everybody, if you could have absolutely afford when you carried a cloak. And it was a large, heavy garment, usually very large, that you could wrap yourself up around in, and it protected you from the elements, whether it was the hot sun in the summer when you're traveling or whether it was from the cold. The other, and you know this time of year, it always astounds me this time of year here because the evenings get cold so fast. The minute the sun goes down. See, I'm not used to, been here 19 years, and I'm still not used to it. I'm still used to Iowa where you have so much humidity that even this time of year in the evening, it still stays warm at night into the evening, and if you don't, it doesn't get cold like it does here so quickly. But having said that, in you have in those parts of the world where those people that they have daytime temperatures that are very hot, and then the temperature drops, and so these people, as they were out, they wrapped up oftentimes in these. So oftentimes their cloak functioned also as a sleeping bag. See? And so that's his point here. He says, if you take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you to return it to him for sundown, before the sunset, for that is his only covering. It is a cloak for his body. What else shall he sleep in? See, you wrapped yourself up in this large cloak. So if you think about that, if you've got a nap, most of you'd carry your sleeping bag on your back if you were packing like this, but they just wore this large garment around them. It shall come about that when he cries out to me, I will hear him, for I am gracious. In other words, when he cries out going, my creditor took my cloak and did not return it. So you gave it to him as a pledge, but it was only with him for the day, and then it had to be returned before sundown. Okay. And verse 28, or at the end of verse 27 there, he says, I will respond, I will hear. Turn also then to Leviticus 18. Leviticus chapter 18. Leviticus 18 and verse... Oh, no, Deuteronomy 24. I'm sorry, I'm looking at the last one going, that's not right. Deuteronomy 24, look with me, beginning at verse 12. Repeats the same thing here. It says... Yes. There's actually a couple things. Let's go back to verse 10. It says, when you make your neighbor a loan of any sort, you shall not enter his house 24. To take...
24:10.
Okay, 24:10. When you make your neighbor a loan of any sort, you shall not enter his house to take his pledge. You shall remain outside, and the man to whom you make the loan shall bring the pledge out to you. We're not absolutely for certain, but a lot of people believe that the reason that they did that was that you weren't supposed to go in and start looking at his stuff going, I'd like that, and I'd like that, and I'd like... Do you get the idea? In other words, they worked those systems. So you stayed out of their house. You didn't go in the house of these people when you were doing this. And then he goes on, and if he is a poor man, you shall not sleep with his pledge. So if he gave a pledge to you for something that you're making a loan to him on, which, remember, was a loan without usury, but he'd give you a pledge, you weren't supposed to keep the pledge with you all night. It goes on, when the sun goes down, you shall surely return the pledge to him, that he may sleep in his cloak and bless you. Implying, obviously, if you're poor, the one thing you'd have would be a cloak to wrap up in at night. You might not have anything else, but you'd have a cloak. And it will be righteousness for you before the Lord your God. Think something as simple as keeping a law in which you return a person's cloak before sundown would have been righteousness for them before God. Now, righteousness before them, before God, not for salvation, but righteousness that would have allowed them to continue going to the temple and having access to priests, which gave them access to God. Okay. Just want us to make sure we're clear on in understanding that. Now we'll go back to Amos. So we have the pledge that they're stretching out on. Apparently stretching out on here, as we've already indicated, because it seems to be connected with the next part, that they're drinking the wine that was either given as a fine or was bought with the fines, whatever it was, and we're not for sure. I'll tell you, when you go and you look at this word for fine and what they did here, it is never used with regard to, excuse me, it is never used with regard to any specific examples. That's what I'm trying to get at here. It's never tied to any specific examples of them actually pledging it. It only occurs about 8 times in the Old Testament. And it says, and so then it goes on in verse 8. It says, yet it was I who destroyed the Amorite before you, though his height was like the height of cedars. And he was strong as the oaks. I even destroyed his fruit above and his root below. And it was I who brought you up from the land of Egypt. And I led you in the wilderness 40 years, that you might take possession of the land of the Amorite. And I raised up some of your sons to be prophets. and some of your young men to be Nazarites. Is this not so, sons of Israel, declares the Lord? Now, what he's doing at this point is he's rehearsed their transgressions. You're doing all these things. You're taking advantage of these people. And yet, I want you to think, the only reason any of you have anything is because I am the one that let you conquer the Amorites. You did not conquer them of yourself. They were like coming up to tall cedars. They were strong. They were powerful. You had no ability to topple them. I gave that to you, their land. Likewise, I delivered you from the land of Israel or from the land of Egypt and brought you to the land 40 years so you could come out here. His whole point is anything you have because I gave it to you. This isn't the only time God has to do this with Israel. Remember the one time over in Isaiah that God rehearses with Israel and he says, you guys were a bloody mess beside the road when I found you. And I cleaned you up and washed you up and I put earrings in your ears and rings in your noses and fixed your hair and put fine clothes. I know, I always think it's funny. The Old Testament, man, they wore jewelry and stuff. And I grew up in a churches where women don't wear jewelry. Well, God talked about putting jewelry on them. Anyway, people get so pure. Puritanism has really messed up Christians, unbelievably so, in so many ways, but that's beside the point. So it says, that's just another one of the illustrations of which God gets on the case of Israel for the fact that they somewhere along the line, in the midst of their prosperity, think that they all achieved this by themselves, or that the other gods around them, as in the case of Hosea, that those other gods helped them achieve their wealth, gave them fine clothes and food and drink and wine. Okay, so he goes on here, and he says, but this is the way they responded. Remember at the end of this? I took some of your men for prophets and some of your young men for Nazarites, but you made the Nazarites drink wine. And you commanded the prophets, saying, you shall not prophesy. The significance of that is, was a Nazarite supposed to touch wine? No. We're not even going to go over there right now. I've got it marked down here. But you, most of us are familiar out of Numbers with the Nazarite vow, the things that they weren't supposed to do when they had a Nazarite vow. They didn't cut their hair. There were certain things that they didn't eat. There were things that they were not allowed to drink. They didn't touch anything for any reason. There was no exceptions on what they could not touch. And yet they made them to drink wine. Second of all, you commanded your prophets, saying, you shall not prophesy. Now, part of the significance of both the Nazarite and the prophets, Nazarites were sometimes used to deliver God's people, as in the case of Samson, who was a Nazarite. But Nazarites also were sometimes given to be those that then God used to provide revelation through. Who was a Nazarite prophet, famous in the Bible? What? Okay.
Jesus was a Nazarite.
Well, he was from Nazareth. He was from Nazareth, but he wasn't actually a Nazarite. John. Remember John? He never touched wine.
John the Baptizer.
Yeah. John the Baptizer is believed by many to actually have been a Nazarite, which is interesting because he was supposed to have been a priest. Remember? His father was a priest. So he should have been raised to become a priest. Instead of becoming a priest, God actually has a totally different plan for him. So he becomes a Nazarite prophet. What they're doing in this case is they're making them violate their Nazarite vow, which is supposed to ruin them. Remember what happened when you violated a Nazarite vow? Then whatever God was doing with regard to the vow that the Nazarite had, out the window. This is the case with Samson. The Holy Spirit left from being upon Samson, and so his strength left from being upon him. And so it says here that you commanded the prophets, then you not prophesy. In other words, what they're doing in both of these cases is they're outright rejecting God's revelation to them. You and I don't appreciate this because we don't have prophets today. We have the Word of God. We read the Bible and we study this. But they were people in their time that needed to have continuing revelation. It's not that the law wasn't good enough, but as it says over in Proverbs, where there is no prophecy or there is no vision, the people cast off restraint. They needed to know regularly that God was continuing to give them revelation.
Carnal person is the same thing today, though.
Oh, I know. Carnal people act just like Israel. They want to keep seeing something new. And then as a result, he says, because I am weighted down beneath you, as a wagon is weighted down when filled with sheaves. And he's talking about this situation here. If you think about how they were doing this, you think of a wagon that's weighted down. And he says, this is the way God is with regard to the people of Israel and the circumstances they're in. They're weighing down what's happening. It's his flight. So he's gonna give these next series of things that he's gonna give them this is what their punishment's gonna be. See, now all the other ones, right? When we read about Damascus and Gaza, it says in here, Gaza and all these other ones prior to this, he said, for these transgressions, for three and for four, and then he enumerates some, and then he gives a penalty. What's going to happen? Well, when he does this one, notice how he says this. Because of the way you've treated me, because you've rejected my revelation. You have had my revelation. Those other nations haven't had my revelation. You have. Now, Judah had, but Israel should have had. They had his revelation, but they tell him to shut up. Don't prophesy. And so he says, because I'm weighted down then, like you've weighted down a wagon with sheaves, this is what's going to happen in verse 14. Flight will perish from the swift. The stalwart will not strengthen his power, nor the mighty man save his life. He who grasps the bow will not stand. The swift of foot will not escape, nor will he who rides the horse save his life. Even the bravest among the warriors will flee naked in that day, declares the Lord. All of those are looking at different individuals in here. In other words, what you had was it's the same thing you do with the military today. You divide all the different people in your military, and you give them all different jobs. So you have people that are real fast. What are you going to do with a fast guy? Give him a bow? Give him a sword? No, you're going to make him a runner in the army that's running things back and forth. So they've got the swift guy. Then they've got the brave guy. You know what you did with the brave guys? And that's the one that's translated in the New American Standard, a stalwart. You know what stalwart did? They were the people that led the charge. They were the people that kept everybody hyped up. You don't want some chicken liver out on the front lines. You want somebody that's out there going, go, we can do this. It's kind of like, you know, you get those like four big men on the line in a football, on the football line of scrimmage, and you put some guys up there that when they get down on the line of scrimmage, they're growling at the defense across from them. You know, they're trying to intimidate. That's the idea when you're talking about this. Then you have the strong man. That's your warrior. So you have your strong warriors. Then you have your bowman soldiers in here. Then you have, again, another word for that refers to, let me catch my ground here. Then you've got another man that's actually a runner. You've got horse riders. Your horsemen weren't always the first line in the way that they did battle, because to be able to ride a horse and ride one well meant that you were a somebody, because not everybody could afford a good horse, much less afford to know how to ride a good horse. I've ridden on horses, but you wouldn't want me to ride one to do anything of anything significance, because I'm terrified that I'm going to get thrown off when that thing gets into a full gallop. Anyway, and then at the end of this, verse 18, and even the bravest then, the bravest of the brave, the ones that are standing there, he flees naked in that day. And probably naked being a reference to the fact that, hey, if you're going to run from the enemy, you don't want to be encumbered by all this stuff that you have put on to go fight battles. So naked probably is a reference not to stripping down to nothing, but dropping all of your armor, your girdle, all the things that you would normally fight for. All of this is picturing what? It's talking about military defeat. And it's talking about all of the different people that were in the army. All of the people with all their jobs. Every one of them. They're not going to be able to stand. They're all going to be terrified. They're all going to run. And they're going to run, but they won't be able to run fast. They're not going to have what they take. So in other words, that concludes the charge against Israel. We'll come.
It says in that day, this is talking about the day of the Lord.
No, I believe that in this context here, he is talking about, I'm just trying to make sure. I'm just gonna hold off on even commenting on that, Ben, because I hadn't even given consideration to whether in that day was a technical expression in this passage, or whether he's simply talking about time of coming judgment. Because most of these judgments that are going to come that he's delineating here are judgments that were going to come more immediately for them. So, but I'm just going to have to. So I've got two questions I'm going to have to answer for you here that I'm going to have to mark down. Well, I'm going to try to write it down here as a note. So, any other questions? Okay.
You know, your comment about the bribe, this is just a comment, about bribes. I don't know if you know Annie Warren, but she married a man from Mexico. And in Mexico, how you get your teaching position is by making a bribe to the superintendent. And then your teaching job is yours for life, kind of like their land. And so when he came up here, he got someone to do his teaching position that still belongs to him. And they do bribes just like, you know, that's part of doing business.
I remember, Dean Hallett telling me this. Dean Hallett used to be a police officer here in Royal City many years ago, and I rode with him in the evenings a couple of times. And then some of the kids that we knew down here that had actually come from Mexico, they don't trust, most Mexicans around here don't trust the police for the same reason. Because for them, the police pull over people over not to give tickets for legitimate crimes, but to get bribes for people. Yeah, for them to pay them off. And so Dean says, man, it's so hard to try to gain the trust of any of these people and let them know that you're actually just trying to uphold the law and you're actually looking out for people's welfare, because they've been raised their life and their parents don't trust them. And anyway.
Yeah, even communism is like that, because when I went to Europe with my mom, we went to Poland. Everything's fine in Germany, kind of a Western culture, but went to Poland, and on the train, the conductor came like in the evening to look at our tickets. Then he wanted to take him. I said, why do you want to? Don't take them. Just, you know, look at them. He said, oh, no, I need to take them. Okay, fine. He took them. Then, like, later that night, in the middle of the night, he was pounding on our door in our little sleeping apartment saying, show me your tickets or I'll throw you off the train. And we said, what are you talking about? You just took them this evening. Show me your tickets or I'll throw you off the train. He wanted a bribe, basically. So while he was harassing my mom and my aunt, I walked out and I went down to his little office and I got the tickets off his desk. I came back and said, oh, man, here's our tickets. So he shut up and went away. But I mean, just how corrupt they are there because of communism, you know.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Maybe it's like Mexico. Our
culture was not, I mean, it's becoming more and more that bribes are okay.
Right.
But
it wasn't set up that way.
It was not set up that way. And that is unusual in the whole scheme of things of the world.
Yeah. And you know, when you put all this together, our main point in here is God has been with all of these. God's going to be bringing his judgment on these people. He is going to have a section in here which he is going to call them to change their ways or to repent. He doesn't actually use the word repent. He says, "Turn to me and live." But when you put this all together, what he's been doing is enumerating the charges. He's been trying to show these people legitimate reasons why I am going to deal with you and why you need to turn around, why you need to change, and legitimate reasons for why God's going to bring judgment against them in this regard. And I just find it real interesting. If you looked at people that were treating other Israelis like this, would you look at them and say that they were people that were demonstrating love? No, you wouldn't. And yet, in reality, you realize if you understand learning, as Paul says, the lessons from what Israel failed to do, that this is a lesson that the church can learn. Because Andrew was asking me about the failure in the dispensation of grace just a couple weeks ago when we were talking about this. What does the church fail to do in the dispensation of grace?
To
To follow the new commandment, which is really good. I, for a long time, I used to say they failed to live by grace. Well, that's only a little part of it. The real thing is God only gave us one commandment. And I think we have a real problem in real Christians now. I'm not talking about just even the church at large, real Christians. And what did God do with the church in Ephesus or warn them that he was going to do because they had left their first love? He says, I'm going to take away your lampstand. You're going to lose your opportunity to witness. And what does Christ do in the rapture? Takes the whole church out. The whole church loses its opportunity to bear witness here on earth. It's over. Because most of the church, at the time of the rapture, will be failing to demonstrate real love to other believers. And it's interesting how many times, even throughout the New Testament, things not as severe as what we're looking at in Amos here, but things, minor things like this with regard to love do crop up, and you see that there are even problems between believers with regard to taking advantage of each other. Anybody else have anything? Let's close them with a word of prayer. Our Father, we are thankful you have given us the privilege of bearing witness to you in this world. You gave Israel the privilege of being a witness to those nations around them, demonstrating that righteousness if they would have lived that law. But we realize that they failed. And we realize as we look at even our own personal lives, but the church in general also, that we really are failing to really live up to living out that kind of love, a love that's impossible for us apart from your Spirit, but a love that you have made possible then through the Spirit. And yet we fail just to use that in our daily, simple, everyday life with other believers, not just those in our church, but any believers that we have contact with. And help us then as we look at your rightful reason for bringing judgment on Israel, that we would be reminded that when you come for us in the rapture, even though we know it is a gracious thing for us, we would also recognize that it is indeed a righteous judgment against the church because the church has failed to love as you've asked us to. Help us to, as those opportunities are presented to us, help us to take those opportunities and to demonstrate love to our fellow believers. And we thank you for that wonderful privilege of being a little part of your plan. And we thank you for that. Amen.